Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 25th of October. Our main stories: the US Vice President Mike Pence launches a scathing attack on China just weeks before his boss President Trump is due to meet the Chinese leader Xi Jinping. The UN is sending a team of human rights specialists to Chile as street protests there continue. And 500 years since the death of Leonardo da Vinci, the Louvre in Paris says it's putting on its best show yet. Also in this podcast:
my son was killed by a Turkish fighter jet. What did we do wrong? When we were fighting IS and we lost so many people, weren't we terrorists then? Why are we now?
We report from inside Syria on the impact of the Turkish offensive. The US Vice President Mike Pence has sharply criticised China just weeks before his boss Donald Trump meets the Chinese leader Xi Jinping to possibly sign a partial trade deal. During a wide-ranging speech, Mr. Pence said China had violated the rights and liberties of people in Hong Kong, and he condemned the Chinese treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. He did say the US wanted a constructive relationship with China, but he also accused it of trying to export censorship to American companies.
Beijing has still not taken significant action to improve our economic relationship. And on many other issues we raised, Beijing's behavior has become even more aggressive and destabilizing. To the millions in Hong Kong who have been peacefully demonstrating to protect your rights these past months, we stand with you.
So why has the US vice president attacked China in this way? Our North America correspondent is Neda Taufik.
This was part of a speech dedicated to really the wide-ranging policy stance of this administration and their relationship with China. It was at the Wilson Center, which is a nonpartisan policy forum. And this speech was actually supposed to take place in June. And Mike Pence at that time really wanted to criticize China for their, what he saw perceived, abuse of religious liberties and human rights violations. And President Trump was concerned in June because he was meaning to meet with President Xi in Japan, and he didn't want that speech to create any tensions ahead of key trade talks. And so this speech was actually delayed from then.
And yet we are just about to have more trade talks. Mike Pence does say the US doesn't seek confrontation with China, but he's pretty critical. What's he trying to achieve?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is, Vice President Pence has always come from a kind of stronger standpoint when it comes to criticizing China on human rights, as well as when it comes to the trade war. And in this speech, he said, you know, we're not seeking to contain China's development. But at the same time, we've seen the Chinese Communist Party continuing to resist a true opening and convergence with global norms. And so here he is really attacking China's place in the wider global community. And it was interesting because he also tried to say that China was trying to export its censorship to the United States. And so he showed a lot of concern about that here. So it's interesting, as trade talks approach and as we know that President Trump again is getting ready for a meeting with President Xi next month in Chile at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, it'll be interesting to see how Vice President Mike Pence's comments may affect those negotiations.
You mentioned the idea of bringing censorship to America. Mike Pence was pretty forceful in his attacks on Nike and the Basketball Association, the NBA, over their relationship with China and what they've been doing with regards to Hong Kong.
Yeah, that's right. This really stems from when the Houston Rockets general manager tweeted in support of pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. And that led to immediate backlash from China. And the NBA and Nike, the vice president said, essentially left their conscience at the door and kowtowed to Beijing. He accused Nike of removing Houston Rockets merchandise from Chinese stores and of the NBA basically basically, as an organization and some of their key players like LeBron James and others, really walking back those comments from the Houston Rockets general manager and instead really supporting Beijing. And he said that a lot of these people who are very quick to criticize, the acts of this administration and to stand up for free speech here in America, well, they lose their voices when it comes to the rights of people in China.
Nedha Tawfiq talking to me from New York. A day after announcing a series of reforms aimed at ending protest in Chile, the president there has said public order is improving, but protesters remain on the streets. And as the demonstrations continued, the United Nations announced on Thursday it was sending human rights specialists to monitor the situation. The protests, which have left at least 18 people dead, were sparked by a now suspended increase in metro fares, but they've morphed into wider discontent over living costs and inequality. I heard the latest from Jane Chambers speaking to me from Santiago on Skype.
There are many people on the streets still. This is the second day of a national strike across Chile, and it's not just Santiago. There have been clashes in other cities as well. Talks about clashes in Valparaiso. I would say, though, talking to Chileans and just moving around the city, there is a sense that it is a bit calmer than previous days. More of the metro stations are open and people are moving about more. Maybe it's because people just want it to get calmer. But yes, these clashes are going on, absolutely.
And what is the UN hoping that this team of human rights specialists will do in Santiago?
Well, it's very interesting because it's headed up by Michelle Bachelet, who's obviously the UN human rights chief and also the former president of Chile. And she has been keeping an eye on things since it kicked off last Friday. And they want to verify allegations of what's going on, of various abuses of people who've accused both the military and the police of using excessive force, including torture against demonstrators. And there is lots flying around social media at the moment of allegations about these things. And obviously the UN are worried about that and need to send people down. But also the Chilean National Human Rights Institute are very much looking into it and gaining access into hospitals and police stations and verifying numbers. There are many numbers which people are trying to verify. It's very difficult to quantify at the moment.
Jane Chambers in the Chilean capital. If you listened to the podcast this time yesterday, you may have heard our correspondent Gia Gol talk about the continued Kurdish anger over the US withdrawal from northeastern Syria. Kurdish forces left more positions along the border with Turkey on Thursday, complying with a deal that sees Syria, Turkey and Russia fill the vacuum left by the US departure. Gia Gol, who works for the BBC Persian service, recently returned from inside Syria, and this is his report from there.
As we cross the Tigris River from Iraq into Syria, it's not long before we bump into dozens of military vehicles heading the opposite way.
This is an American convoy. You can see American flags. They are pulling out of the region. It seems to me they are special forces. They have been here in the past 3 years, aiding the Kurds in the fight against ISIS.
11,000 Kurdish men and women were killed in the war against the Islamic State. Now their long-term ally, the US, is leaving them to face an even bigger threat alone. For Turkey, armed Kurdish fighters on its border is a national security threat, which they say is linked to its own Kurdish militancy. Eight-year-old Sarah is one of the casualties. She is lying on a hospital bed. Her father is cuddling her, trying to comfort her. We're in the predominantly Kurdish border town of Qamishli. Sarah has lost one leg, and her other leg is badly injured. Her father says they were shelled by Turkish forces.
I was at home. It was around 3:30 in the morning. The shell landed on our street, right in front of our door.
As Sarah lies on the bed, playing with a colored ball, she describes what happened.
Hamoudi was next to the door, and me and my friend were by the gate. And then a shell hit.
Sarah doesn't know that her brother is dead. Her father doesn't think she would cope.
The Syrian Kurdish leadership has sought to save lives by doing a deal with Russia and Syrian President Assad in Damascus. Their self-ruled administration is in danger, and they are fearful of coming under regime control. More than 100,000 people have had to flee their homes. Nezgin is 52 years old and is mourning her dead son, who fought to defend their homeland.
My son was killed by a Turkish fighter jet. What did we do wrong? Why did Erdogan do this to us? We're living in our own land. Are we taking anything from Erdogan? When we were fighting IS and we lost so many people, weren't we terrorists then? Why are we now?
Mezgin, a Kurdish mother, ending that report from the BBC's GR Goal on the impact of the Turkish offensive in northern Syria. The remains of General Franco, the fascist dictator who ruled Spain for almost four decades, have been exhumed and reburied. The socialist government of Spain said it was concerned that his tomb at a grand mausoleum had become a shrine for the far right. But Franco's relatives believe his reburial is a political move ahead of next month's general election. Alan Little in Madrid sent this report.
Franco's coffin was lifted away from the vast stone edifice that has been his ostentatious tomb since 1975. The Valley of the Fallen dominates the landscape for miles around. It has come to symbolise for many here something discordant in a modern democracy, the lionising of a dictator. Franco's family were not allowed to drape the coffin in the Spanish flag, for this was Spain very publicly disowning its fascist past. But many here opposed this exhumation. The Franco loyalist Norberto Pico of the nationalist Spanish Falange Party told me the socialist government was rewriting history.
It's a way of revising it, to push half of Spain into a corner, the heirs of those who won the Civil War, to the grandchildren of those whose lives Francisco Franco saved through military action. He's considered a hero. This is reawakening old ghosts, using what happened 80 years ago for political reasons.
But to victims of Franco's dictatorship, his tomb was an offence, glorifying fascism. Nicolas Sanchez Albornoz, now 93, was forced to work on its construction.
The intention behind the building is a monument to the victory of a crusade. It's not an attempt to bring together the people of a nation. And I think that the presence of a monument like that is deepening into the new generation the sense of division.
Franco's remains were transferred to a private family plot, Europe's last fascist leader, symbolically removed from Spain's public realm.
A report by Alan Little in Madrid. Zimbabwe has flown up to 30 young elephants to another country, thought to be China. The sale has been criticised by animal welfare groups who say the creatures may be traumatised. But Zimbabwe's National Park Service has defended the move, saying they need to raise funds to protect other wildlife during a devastating drought. Our Southern Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports.
Video footage obtained by the BBC shows some 30 young elephants in an enclosure just hours before they were flown out of Zimbabwe earlier today. It's a year since the animals were captured and separated from their families. Inspectors from Zimbabwe's National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals say they were blocked illegally from accessing the elephants. Animal welfare groups say the whole process has been shrouded in secrecy and that these highly socialised animals will face a bleak future in unsuitable Chinese zoos or parks. But a spokesman for Zimbabwe's national parks said the sale of the elephants was necessary, not least because of a devastating drought. Next month, new international rules will strictly limit this sort of trade. But Zimbabwe insists it has far too many elephants in its parks and should be allowed to sell some under appropriate supervision.
Andrew Harding. Still to come in the podcast.
We didn't want a character based on her seductive side, as we usually do with female characters. Most of the time, they're young, attractive women who seduce obelisks, and their role stops there.
Asterix the Gaul gets its first female heroine. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has tried to regain the political initiative after his opponents blocked his Brexit plans. On Tuesday, they voted down his timetable to pass his withdrawal deal in time for the UK to leave on October the 31st, as he'd promised, do or die, come what may. He's now offered them more time to scrutinise the agreements if they allow him to call an early general election. He was speaking to the BBC's political editor, Laura Koonsberg.
We've had 3.5 years to discuss this. We're being very, very reasonable. We're saying, if you genuinely want more time, you can have it. Here it is. But the condition for that is that we all agree to go for a general election on December the 12th. And the reason for having that deadline is because otherwise, I don't think the people of this country are going to believe that Parliament is really going to do it by that deadline. Because they spent 3.5 years failing to do it. So let's get it done and let's come out of the EU.
But Prime Minister, it's not standard behaviour. You're essentially trying to blackmail Parliament with the threat of an election in order to ram through your bill. Now, this is the biggest thing, I'm sure you would say this, that this country has done for decades and decades and decades. You could just say, fine, let's have as long as it takes to get through this line by line in Parliament. Well, would that not be the responsible thing to do?
No, come on. We've had 3.5 years.
Not looking at this bill.
Well, most of this bill is, of course, very familiar to parliamentarians. And as I say, when they had the opportunity to debate the actual deal the other day, they couldn't find enough speakers to fill the debate. This is something that's been super masticated in our democracy.
They've been over it
a long time.
And there are big changes compared to your deal and the previous deal.
And so what we're saying, Laura, is that there's going to be more time now allocated for all MPs to come together and look at it. And starting from now, starting from tonight if necessary, right the way through to when Parliament would rise on November the 6th, there is a long period to debate, discuss the provisions in this withdrawal agreement.
Boris Johnson talking to the BBC's Laura Koonsberg. But to get an election, he needs rival parties to agree. The leader of the main opposition Labour Party is Jeremy Corbyn.
Take no deal off the table and we absolutely support an election. I've been calling for an election ever since the last one because this country needs one in order to deal with all the social injustice issues. But no deal must be taken off the table.
But to be clear, if there's a vote on Monday on a December the 12th general election, what will you tell Labour MPs to do?
Tomorrow the European Union will decide whether there's going to be an extension granted or not. That extension will obviously encompass whether there's a no deal or not. Let's find that out tomorrow.
So it could be that you back an election on Monday for December the 12th?
The principle is take no deal off the table, EU answer tomorrow, then we can decide.
Jeremy Corbyn speaking on Thursday evening. So what does it all mean? Our political correspondent is Rob Watson.
It seems to me that what's happened here is Boris Johnson has basically decided that, look, his best interest, the best interest of his governing Conservative Party and the best interest of getting Brexit done depend on having an early election. And you wouldn't be surprised to think that that's what he thinks if he's looked at the opinion polls where he has a very healthy lead. And if they were to be borne out, he would have a pretty healthy majority. But of course, the opposition get a say. So for the opposition parties, I mean, in some ways, you'd think that the best thing they could do is just play for time, delay. Mr. Johnson can't get his bill, can't get his election, just let him stew. But what exactly would their message to the electorate be, beyond hoping that something else turns up?
Rob Watson. Next to China, where, according to reports from the central city of Xi'an, a man temporarily went blind after playing games on his phone in the dark. The doctor who treated him said the man suffered a stroke in one of his eyes as a result of a clot or a narrowing of the blood vessels. Eye strokes have been rising in China as a result of smartphones, and the government in Beijing has issued a warning over it. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen told me more.
Well, there's been this video that's circulated online of this doctor talking about how he's received more than 20 people a month for what he describes as an eye stroke, which is where you go temporarily blind from looking at your phone too long, often at night in the dark. So suddenly, he said that this affects people older and younger. People have been looking at their phones and suddenly realising that they can't see. So they've had to get rushed to the doctors.
And is this a particular problem in China?
It is, yes, because there is huge mobile phone usage. In fact, the most recent data on this suggests that it's nearly 6 hours a day that people are spending on average looking at their phone. So that's about a quarter of a day, really, that people are in front of their mobile phone, looking on social media, reading the news.
And so what is the government saying? Just stop, give up. Perhaps limit your time?
Well, there has been a government campaign over a long period of time now from Xi Jinping, the president, to try and change the lifestyles of people, because with people looking increasingly at their mobile phones, spending a lot of time indoors on computers, not getting enough natural light, there are problems that are increasingly appearing in Chinese society that people are having difficulty with their eyes. And this has become apparent from young people as well. So the government has been trying to make a change, not just in the amount of time people are spending on mobile phones, but a broader change in people's lifestyles so that people are actually spending more time outside and appreciating the fresh air.
And so have people been responding to this warning, perhaps online?
Yeah, people are very shocked, but they're saying that it's going to be difficult to actually give up your mobile phone because people are increasingly dependent on them in Chinese society. So much so, in fact, that a lot of apps that people have, I mean, one of the biggest apps being WeChat, which is China's version of WhatsApp, you can do everything with it. I mean, you can't just chat with your friends. You can also pay for things in restaurants. You can book cinema tickets. You literally live your life through your mobile phone now in China.
Kerry Allen. It's 500 years since the death of Leonardo da Vinci, born near Florence and widely hailed as the greatest of all artists. There have already been several big exhibitions to mark the anniversary, but the Louvre in Paris claims its new show will be unmissable. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd reports.
Much talk before the new show in Paris has been of what won't be in it for now. Yet most experts think there are only between 14 and 17 surviving paintings by Leonardo, so curator Vincent Delieuva is delighted his museum has assembled so many of them, beautifully displayed.
We have already 5 paintings, 22 drawings, so it was easier for us to organize that exhibition. So thanks to that, we were able to gather here most of his paintings and a wonderful selection of drawings.
The most famous piece on loan is Leonardo's Vitruvian Man from around 1490. Endlessly reproduced, it shows a naked man with arms extended to illustrate human physical proportions. Normally, the image lives in Venice.
It's a fragile drawing, and in Venice, they usually never lend that drawing, so it was quite difficult. But at the end, I think our colleagues in Italy were aware that it was great also to see that drawing in the context of Leonardo's life with other scientific drawings of the master.
But what the art world had hoped for was the picture of Christ by Leonardo, sold at auction by Christie's New York 2 years ago.
352 million is bid. At $352 million.
The Salvator Mundi, which not everyone accepts is a work entirely by Leonardo, was bought by or on behalf of wealthy figures in the Middle East. The hammer price staggered observers.
Leonardo Salvator Mundi selling here at Christie's. $400 million is the bid, and the piece is sold.
With extra charges, the final price was $450 million, the most ever paid for a painting at auction. Since when, it has, in effect, disappeared. So, where is it? The Louvre has close connections in the Gulf, so does Vincent Delieuva still hope the Salvator Mundi will hang in this show as a late arrival?
It's possible. It depends on what the owner wants to do with the painting. We asked the painting a long time ago, before its sale in 2017. And so if the owner would like to present the painting in the exhibition, we'll be very pleased to.
For now, there's lots more on offer, such as a virtual reality Mona Lisa. One of the reasons for having a virtual Mona Lisa is that, ironically, the real thing is not in the new exhibition. It's in the Louvre, of course, but Vincent Delieuva says it just could not be moved.
It was absolutely impossible. We think about sending the exhibition upstairs, but it was too difficult. The drawings needs not a lot of light, and upstairs we have too much light, so it was absolutely impossible. It's a pity, because we would have loved to have the Mona Lisa, which is a masterpiece of Leonardo da Vinci.
You can go and see the Mona Lisa before or after taking in the new show, joining the other 30,000 people who do so each day. And if the Louvre does get to borrow the Salvator Mundi, those visitor figures will rocket.
Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd. For 60 years, the French comic book hero Asterix has been resisting the Roman occupation of Gaul. He's now onto his 38th adventure. It was published on Thursday, and as Daniel Mann reports, for the first time the story features a female heroine.
Until now, 50 BC, when Gaul is entirely occupied by the Romans, has been a man's world. The indomitable Asterix has always managed to outwit his enemies with the help of the superhuman strength of his best friend Obelix, Obelix's bad-tempered pet Dogmatix, and the magic potion conjured up by the village druid Getafix. Now, in a radical departure, the plot in the latest edition, La Fille de Vousin Getarix, Asterix and the Chieftain's Daughter, centres around Adrenaline, the teenage child of a Gaulish king. She has long red braided hair, wears black trousers, walks around with gold headphones, and carries a dagger. Like so many adolescents, she's in a rebellious mood as the Romans hunt her down. Adrenaline's secret refuge is Asterix and Obelix's village, the only place that can guarantee her safety. But they must overcome the generation gap as they protect her from the invaders. Didier Conrad, who draws the cartoons, says it's time the men faced a new challenge.
En même temps, vu qu'on ne voulait pas développer un personnage qui soit axé sur le côté séductrice comme
we didn't want a character based on her seductive side, as we usually do with female characters. Most of the time, they're young, attractive women who seduce Obelix, and their role stops there. At the beginning of the story, Adrenaline has a silhouette in the form of an S, so she's a bit round-shouldered and grumpy. As she starts to assert herself, she stands up straight.
A Gaulish teenage lexicon has been invented for her, which, like previous editions, is translated from the original French. Since 1959, the Asterix books have sold more than 370 million copies. They can be read in more than 100 languages, and they've been turned into hugely popular films and cartoons.
Daniel Mann. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.